This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, U.S. cops act like soldiers, and U.S. soldiers think they are the police of the world. A Black activist explains the connection. And another left activist says this is the year to take on the corporate Democrats on their own turf, and he's targeted House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is preparing to descend on Washington on the first weekend in November, as the coalition has done every year since Barack Obama's first year in the White House. The arch-racist Donald Trump is now the chief executive. But Black is Back Chairman Omari Eshetela says the enemy remains the same, U.S. imperialism and white supremacy.
Well, you know, I think it's really important because there's so much stuff that's happening in the world that the United States government is obviously involved in, even though there's ongoing need to make Donald Trump responsible for it. Our understanding, of course, is that it's the government itself and that there's a serious crisis that the whole imperialist system is going through. And I think that for us, the significance of our coalition in part is the fact that we do represent about 15, 16 different organizations and a lot of different individuals who are there. And then there are people who beyond our organizations who come out to our meetings. And I think that what we've learned in the past, Glenn, that makes this slogan, turn imperialist wars into wars against imperialism, so meaningful is especially during a period like this where the U.S. is fighting on every front. It's initiating battles and it is being scarred by these battles that it has begun, whether it's the fight trade war with China, whether it's the attack on Iran. And also there's an obvious crisis in Iraq and the Brexit stuff. The whole world economy is sort of being reconfigured right now. And that's a world economy that's not friendly to the oppressed. It's not friendly to African people. So one of the things that we learned in the past is that it's necessary not just to simply protest and condemn what the United States government is doing in various places around the world, but to open up new fronts of struggle here within the United States. So the United States has to become preoccupied with fighting battles right here. And I think that while it's really good and nice to protest what the United States is doing in Venezuela, what the war that it actually is conducting against Iran in the form of economic quarantine, et cetera, what's really going to be helpful is for us to demand that people who really are solidarity with the struggle for African people and solidarity with the struggle of people in Venezuela and Iran and all those places really support the Black liberation movement in this country. That the way that we can really tie up the United States and force it to begin to back off what it's attempting to do in some of these other places is to open up meaningful fronts. That force everybody who says that they hate what the United States is doing in Venezuela or doing with Iran, the threats it's making to Russia and everybody else, to force the United States to have to deal with the question of reparations, to force the United States to have to deal with the questions of political prisoners. I was at an event a little more than a couple of weeks ago, and I heard a peace activist talking about the case of Julius Assange and Chelsea Manning, who have been arrested for releasing information showing the culpability of the United States in crimes all around the world. But they didn't mention Sundi Adekola. They didn't mention even people like Mumia, who has become rather the iconic political prisoner. And I think that we need to say they must open up these struggles around the political prisoners of African people. They need to be joining with the struggle that African people and the Mexicans and oppressed people right here engaged in a very active way, not just protesting, but uniting with the actual struggles that's being initiated here and those which the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations are forwarding as well. So when we say turn imperialist wars into wars against imperialism, what we are calling on is for the whole, certainly the African community and the Black liberation movement as it exists, but also others who claim to be anti-imperialist and who claim to be pro-peace and against war. we're calling on them to actively engage in confronting the United States right here in this country around what's happening to us. Don't just condemn what Trump is doing and talking about walls and immigration, et cetera. Open up a new front and demand not just that we don't deal with putting up walls and all this other garbage and the attack on immigrants and attack on children, but even open up a demand calling on the United States to return to Mexico, the land that was stolen at gunpoint, that's called Texas and Arizona and California and Utah and New Mexico, et cetera. My point is that while much of the left will find that these are extraordinary kinds of demands, but they are the demands that I think necessary to push the United States right here within its own existing borders so that it has to be preoccupied with this war and cannot initiate and continue the initiation of wars against other peoples around the world.
The world has changed a great deal since Che Guevara issued his call for one, two, many Vietnams. Back then, the United States was bombing and invading a nation much weaker than itself, although eventually it had to stop. But now, today, the U.S. is involved in a trade war with China, an economy that, by some measures, is bigger than its own, and threatening the European Union, whose economy is as big as its own, if it doesn't honor the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran.
Well, I do think that it's a bit of bullying that sort of exposes the crisis dilemma that the United States is involved in, because the trade war with China and Brexit included, and Boeing included, and the strike with General Motors included. I mean, all of these things are factors contributing to a reconfiguration of the whole economy. I mean, there's been a slowdown in the economy in the United States. Germany's economy is stagnant, and this is, of course, the largest economy in Europe. And, of course, when we're talking about the European Union, some would argue that there is no Europe. I've seen a commentary on that question, and Brexit, of course, is a clear example of the fragility of that. And then there are other countries who exist within what is characterized as the European Union, who are talking about breaking away from that as well. I mean, the entire thing is in a state of crisis, and it's a serious kind of dilemma for not only the United States, but for imperialism overall. It's a critical moment for us, and we must not accept the crisis of imperialism as our own crisis. In fact, it's our responsibility to do what we can to deepen the crisis of imperialism again so that the U.S. would have to be preoccupied with protecting itself, so that it cannot continue to run amok against all of the other peoples around the world. It's a very tenuous situation that the U.S. is involved in, that the world economy is involved in, the seesawing, whiplash activity of the stock market being a part of the example that speaks to the uncertainty that so-called investors and the bourgeoisie itself are confronting with when trying to make plans for their own self-interest. It's a different world, as you said, than when Che first said it, but the fragility of imperialism, I think, is even deeper now than it was then. A weakness now, of course, is that our liberation movement is unclear on so many other questions, because I spoke to someone who's a friend of Robert Williams, you know, the brother who was from Monroe, North Carolina, who had to escape this country after fighting the Klan and what have you in the 1950s, and ended up, among other places, in Cuba and China and Vietnam. And I was told about how at a banquet he did a salute to Vo Nguyen Gia, who was this incredible general who had defeated first the French and the U.S., and that Gia returned the compliment saying that I should salute you because of what the African people in this country, the United States, were doing with the uprisings, et cetera, that he claimed that the Vietnamese learned from. So I think that's pretty significant, and I think it's significant in part because it is clear that the United States government at different times had to bring troops back from Vietnam to confront Africans in this country and in Detroit, I understand, in Newark, and other places like that. So the fact that the United States can run around doing what it is doing speaks volumes about the uncertainty in many ways of our own movement and what it is that we think we are fighting for. But I think we've tried to contribute to some clarity on that question when we recognize, first of all, that we are talking about imperialism, and imperialism is making war and threatening war against the peoples of the world, and that we have a responsibility, again, not just to fight for some kind of peace on the plantation or some kind of imperialist peace, but to initiate a struggle against this imperialism ourselves.
President Trump does not appear to be as active militarily, that is, in starting and conducting big new wars as his predecessor, but he certainly has gone wild with sanctions.
Yeah, he's done that. And while everybody's watching Trump, what he does and does not do, there's very little being said about the fact that the United States, the Democratic Party, the so-called liberals, none of them are fighting Trump because of his aggressions against Iran. None of them are fighting Trump because of his aggressions against China and the possibility that this guy and his politics can contribute to a real nuclear conflagration. So he uses the sanctions, and we don't even hear the liberals in the Democratic Party or the so-called moderates in the Republican Party complaining about the sanctions. This is U.S. policy. Trump is the front person for it right now. And of course, the sanctions are acts of war. I mean, people are starving and dying as a consequence of that. And then in addition to the sanctions, there are the other aspects of this undeclared war that's being made through cyberspace, wars that's been made against Iran now with Israel for a long period of time, attacking their computers and their ability to improve their own military capacity. These things are happening. And Trump, as you mentioned, obviously is really escalating this whole war on trade. And I think the trade war is becoming increasingly problematic, and it's creating some fractures within the imperialist United Front. Because, like you mentioned earlier, I think you inferred, if you didn't say it explicitly, because the United States is now talking about an escalation of the trade war against Europe and the European Union. And the World Trade Organization has given Trump the go-ahead to apply tariffs on European products of several billion dollars. And this is extremely problematic. I mean, even if they can declare that within bourgeois legal terms that is legal, the problem is that as legal as it may be, it's extraordinarily problematic for the world economy, which is an imperialist economy.
Of course, even more extraordinary than trade wars are the sanctions that use the dollar, the world reserve currency, as a weapon.
Yeah, I think that it's another instance of the imperialists not being able to do anything right, because what Trump is doing is escalating this entire process that began some time ago with different countries attempting to challenge the hegemony of the dollar. And some countries are doing this in combination. Of course, China's making magnificent strides in that direction, and other countries have been. I mean, that's part of what Hugo Chavez was trying to do before he was killed. And even, you know, Libya was involved in trying to challenge that. There were different countries who were involved in that process. And I think that what's happening now with the sanctions is that the United States government is really pushing and escalating this move by other peoples and countries to challenge and get rid of the hegemony of the United States dollar. And I know that's happening. I mean, different countries are coming to different kinds of arrangements, despite sometimes in the face even of the bullying and threats by the United States government.
Black Democrats don't talk about foreign policy. The founder of Black Lives Matter, Alicia Garza, caused the publication of a huge census of black people that asked lots of questions, but not one on foreign policy. Why is it necessary for black people engaged in struggle here on the ground in the U.S. to keep their eyes on what's happening in the world and to make alliances with people not within our borders?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that that would even be a question today is because a certain kind of lack of development of the African liberation movement that the Black is Black Coalition is attempting to address with the whole question of turning the imperialist wars into wars against imperialism. It is trying to remind African people that we are a part of the world. We don't just live in New Jersey. We're part of the world, and the world is engaged in a very serious struggle to rid itself of the clutches of imperialism and the world economy that is an imperialist world economy that strangles every other country that attempts to maintain the subservience of peoples around the world so that we cannot become economically self-reliant, and that overthrows governments and countries in order to maintain the superiority or the supremacy of not only of the U.S. dollar, but of imperialism altogether. And so it's extremely important because we don't even know when we're winning. Sometimes we fight for the wrong side because we don't understand often. We don't provide the leadership, I should say, coming from revolutionary sectors to the base of our population that would help them to understand, as we did so often understand in the 1960s, that the struggle in Vietnam at that time was our struggle. Che wasn't speaking to himself, to an echo chamber, when he said that he made that statement at a time where people around the world were able to unite and rally with that. We're talking about a time when the Black Liberation Movement had moved away from this kind of simple-minded domestic politics. I mean, Malcolm X, of course, was one of the most extraordinary leaders of our movement out of that. And even King, when he went and began to talk about Vietnam, had to go against the advice of people who were with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, other leaders, as well as the so-called civil rights movement as a whole. Because given an opportunity, there are those people who would maintain the liberation struggle of our people as a U.S. domestic problem. And we are saying that we are nobody's domestic, and that those days are over, and that African people have to fight for our independence and fight for our self-determination. And to do that, we can unite with other people who are struggling for self-determination, primarily with other African people, and then other people who are fighting for self-determination, and other people who can ally with those of us who are fighting for self-determination, because in the final analysis, the whole capitalist system rests upon a pedestal of our oppression, our exploitation. That is to say, not only African people, but the other peoples of the world from whom tremendous amount of resources are being extorted in every day of our lives. And that's the thing that's up to now been able to keep the whole imperialist system afloat. So if we really want to talk about freedom, then we have to recognize that imperialism itself has to be fought, has to be attack, has to be defeated, and the essence, the critical component of that struggle to defeat imperialism is the struggle of Africans and other colonized peoples of the world.
That was Black is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshetela speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida. Mass shootings, militarism, and policing are chapters in the same manifesto. So says the title of a recent article by Derica Purnell, a movement lawyer, writer, and activist. We asked Purnell how she came to that conclusion.
I am completely sure that it is informed by so many people who I've read and studied, you know, within the Black radical tradition. So these are not, I don't think, particularly original ideas. I just know that I was inspired to put them on paper after seeing this tweet from this congressperson who said, after a mass shooting, he says, if you want to shoot an assault rifle, join the military. If you really want to get your issue off, there's a way for you to do that legally, right? There's a way for you to target and play around with guns and not kill U.S. civilians or U.S. citizens, you can go abroad and use assault rifles in other countries. And unfortunately, you know, that's a logic that drives open white supremacists to join the police. It inspires certain type of, you know, militiamen, people who think that they've missed their Confederate moment to join the police, to join the military, to then go and exert violence on people of color, people, you know, poor communities, and join the National Guard or to join the military to go acting that violence abroad. And so it's unfortunate that that logic, that we already have a pattern and practice of people who are eager to use violence against people of color, particularly oppressed people, to go do that. Like, they can do that in legitimate ways. And so what happens when these mass shooting moments happen, there's a sense of relief when we find out that there's some sort of manifesto that shows the world that, you know, hey, I'm a racist and I want to go hurt people of color. But it's much harder when you look at the regular acts of police violence and you look at the regular acts of military violence and to say, well, these are also acts of white supremacy. Like, we must see them as the same. And so that's how I came to that conclusion in the piece.
So the United States glorifies persons it sends to other countries who strut around somebody else's land shooting people, but frowns upon it here and doesn't see the contradiction.
Well, sometimes frowns upon it here, but yes, I think that they are people in power, politicians. They have a sigh of relief when there's explicit racism and explicit named white supremacy. But whenever there's not explicit white supremacy or a manifesto to be located, then we see a much more complicated story come out about the killer, right? So we have some killers where there is no manifesto. So then we hear politicians say, you know, this is a disturbed individual. This was someone who, you know, was a lone wolf, or this is someone who was really quiet, really shy, and we don't know where any of this comes from. You know, ignoring the fact that we are in two wars right now, and we have militarism, militaristic presence in several hundred countries. And so we have so many overt and covert military operations. We have police who regularly, you know, assault, kill, imprison, arrest, harass people across the country. And then when someone decides to shoot up a school or to shoot up a movie theater, it's like, well, where are they getting this violent behavior from? It's like, well, there's always violent behavior that's going around, and most of it comes from the U.S. government.
In terms of police, it's almost universal in police departments and in the U.S. Justice Department to talk about community policing, whatever that is. But you say that community policing, and you quote other scholars, you describe community policing as being stylized after military patrols with local people during wars overseas.
Yeah, it's one of the most fascinating things I've learned in the last few years. So Kristen Blackman is this organizer and anarchist who writes about policing. And he has two books. One is Our Enemies in Blue. The second one is called Fire the Cops. And in it, he talks about the origin of policing. And he talks about how militaries are styled after police, even though we think that the police is now becoming militarized. He says that they both inform and, you know, reinforce each other. And he says that, you know, here are these tactics that soldiers use abroad to build relationships with the people in which they're enacting their military violence upon. You know, they're using, you know, this community-style militarism to gather intel and data to build relationships that then gives them information about the people in the community. And I don't even know if all soldiers really even know that's what they're doing on purpose, but that's the function of building those sort of relationships with people who are abroad. And so what has happened is that now we have, you know, in St. Louis, where I'm from, we have police officers who are driving through communities, passing out ice cream. There's like police ice cream trucks, and they're trying to build these relationships because that's how they get data and intel on people in the community. And it's really unfortunate, you know, it's really, really unfortunate. And another piece I've written about how in these consent decrees from the Department of Justice that emphasize community policing, we see complaints against police officers go down, but we see the use of force increase in over half of them or stay the same. So when there's more community policing emphasis, it's unfortunate that people are less likely to respond and to report or complain about the police officers who are harassing them or who are bothering them, even though police are using no less force in most of the cases.
So the police largely see so-called community policing as a prophylactic, a preventative against community complaints against the police.
Yeah, I think that's likely. I think that's true. I think policing is very, very interesting. I don't even think that a lot of people within the institution are particularly even critical or aware. You know, I know at least one or two police officers who became police officers because they were brutalized as kids and they didn't want to be the type of officer that they encountered as young Black men. They grew up to join a police force. Now, I think there's other things that they could have done with their time. You know, there's this short amount of time that we have on this planet, but I don't even think that they're completely aware, some of them, of how community policing function. And it's unfortunate because you have communities who are demanding more community policing as opposed to militaristic policing, but they're actually one and the same.
Well, there certainly hasn't been any resistance to the militarization of police by the Congressional Black Caucus. Back in 2014, 80%, 4 out of 5 of the caucus members voted not to abolish the Pentagon's 1033 program, whereby they distribute billions of dollars in weapons and gear to local police.
I think I remember in 2014, when the Ferguson uprising happened after Darren Wilson murdered Michael Brown, I remember reading a report that talked about how people, I'm pretty sure, and I will have to double check whether, you know, Congressman Lacey Clay and Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver, at one point I lived in either one of their districts in Kansas City when it was under Cleaver, and then in St. Louis under Clay, how both of these people who were condemning police violence, you know, had just voted to give all this equipment to the police department, to St. Louis County, not just Ferguson, but St. Louis County. There was a central unified command force that had this military equipment that they used against protesters. And then every day, I know that the emphasis is often on protesters, but police officers use this military equipment in SWAT raids. They use them to set up shop in neighborhoods and just post these huge electronic monitoring equipment. You know, there's one in my neighborhood, unfortunately. You know, we see them in parking lots of supermarkets. So instead of hiring a police officer, there are these panels, these solar panels with cameras and the light. There's a blue light that's always flashing, and there's wheels. So it's like some sort of mobile unit that they're using to surveil parking lots. So then surveillance state is creasing with the transfer of the military equipment from the Pentagon. And it's so much so that people are just starting to accept it as normal. They just, oh, you go to Target, there's this police, you know, station that's in the parking lot that's unmanned, and you just park your car, you go in and you go out. You know, how many people are stopping in the customer service and saying, hey, why are there these, you know, militaristic equipment in the parking lot? Like, what's going on there? It's just sort of taking it for granted.
Both of the Missouri congresspersons voted to keep 1033 in 2014, as we reported in Black Agenda Report. Only last year, 75% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to make the police a protected class. And that means making assaults on police a hate crime.
Well, one unfortunate, you know, truth about the caucus, and I would say that it's probably true of a lot of Black people who take themselves to be trying to do the right thing and representing mayors and police chiefs and many police officers, and also representing people who are assaulted and harassed regularly by police. It's in the spirit of, you know, how do we take these officers and take this community and build trust and build relationships? And so the spirit of which, well, I don't want to be too critical of police because I have to represent them in my district and I want to win again. And they're trying to toe the line between being critical of police brutality or bad apple cops with trying to also show police that they're also on their side. The problem is that people who are regularly experience police violence, interestingly, which includes Black officers while they're in the force, you know, so there is no equivalent side. There's no police on one side and then community on other side. One is an arm of the state that is empowered to inflict certain types of violence already against people of color, people who are poor. So there is no, you know, these are two objective or neutral parties with equal footing that we have to bring to the table and listen to each other. The institution of policing is problematic. No one was trying to reconcile the relationship between people in the field and overseers. I'm saying, hey, you know, we can just build trust between these two institutions, then maybe, like, we can move forward. Well, the issue is that the role of the overseer was completely problematic. What police do is punish and manage poverty to protect the interests of people who have a lot of money, people who have a lot of power, and people who are usually white. Not all the time, but usually white. And so you can try to make them better at doing their job. You can make them more nice. You can make them more friendly. But making them more friendly does not reduce their capacity or power to harm you. And that's the problem. They're not interested in taking power and capacity away from the police to commit harm.
Yes, and you say the militarization of the police is just capitalism protecting itself. And you quote Gil Scott Heron, "The only thing wrong with peace," he says sarcastically, "is that you can't make any money from it."
Yeah, exactly. You know, you mentioned the 1033 program. So this is quote unquote gently used military equipment that we should give to America's local police departments, because that's how they can then go and combat the violence in their communities or these dangerous drug dealers. You know, we need to transfer it to school districts. The LA school district had military equipment that organizers forced them to give back. Because why does a school district, why does anyone need this equipment, let alone a school district? And so what happens when you recycle these weapons, these helicopters, you know, this tear gas, all this stuff to police departments, well, then you need new inventory, right? So who do you think is lobbying to keep the 1033 program going? Well, it's the people who is providing the inventory. It's job security. It's money. It's how you keep replenishing the military if they have somewhere to get it. You know, if you have a tank that's 5 years old and I want to sell you a tank, you know, this is the newest version, well, you got to get that tank out of your military into your local police department or to somewhere abroad. And that's how we're going to keep supplying the weapons. That's how we're going to keep supplying the military equipment. You have to get it out and then replenish.
And you seem to be saying that instead of all this fixation on, well, just gun control, what we need is a broad movement based on human needs involving masses of people.
Oh, absolutely. I think that I have complicated feelings about gun control because, one, America has too many guns. There's too many guns. Two, the Second Amendment has been interpreted by the Supreme Court in the loosest fashion possible, whereas an interpretation about militia has now been read at, you know, you have a Second Amendment, a right to bear arms as an individual. Three, I don't trust the U.S. government to be the only entity in this country that should have weapons, so I have complicated feelings about that. But four, the gun control conversation is ultimately going to fall down on people who are poor and people of color, specifically Black people. And so as I'm looking at the gun control debate and what people are putting on the table, credit checks, well, who doesn't have access to credit? Black people, poor people. So if you don't need credit to buy a gun, you can just get a loan from someone in your family who has money, or they can just give it to you. Well, you can still go and buy the gun, right? If you have a record, well, who disproportionately has records in this country? People of color, Black people, Black men, poor people. These are all the people who have records. So we have like, well, you can't have any of these records when you have police who are disproportionately targeting and arresting people. You have prosecutors disproportionately trumping up charges on poor people and people of color. You have judges doing sentencing enhancements and mandatory minimums. Well, the people who are going to be locked out of the gun control debate are going to be people with records, and that's people of color and poor people, right? People with mental health issues, who are much more likely to be victims than to be people who are committing the act. And so the mass shooting conversation ignites all of these conversations about gun debates, but no one I have seen yet say, look, if we pass all of these gun control measures, would it have stopped any of these white men who didn't have a history of mental health issues, who got weapons because they had fine credit, or if they would have done a background check, would have been fine, would it actually have prevented any of the mass shootings from happening?
And in many southern states that have open carry laws, it would be legal for lots of Black folks to carry guns in public, but you better not.
Well, we know that's happened twice. We know that happened, I believe that was in North Carolina. And I remember the story. He was in a car and his wife or his fiance was on a balcony and he was shot in a state that was open carry state. So there we go. We have John Crawford, I think, also in Ohio, open carry state, was in a Walmart holding a gun, a toy gun at that, and was shot and killed. And then you have people like Philando Castile, who was killed in Minnesota. He told the officer that he had a license to carry. He had done all the paperwork. had a gun, told the officer, hey, officer, you know, you're asking me to open up this compartment. I want to give you a heads up. I have a gun, gets killed anyway. And then his lawyers are fighting, you know, his lawyers during the trial where he was acquitted were fighting to keep it out of the record to stop the jury from hearing that Philando Castile has the legal right to carry a gun because he had a legal permit. And they said, well, it's irrelevant because the police officer didn't know whether the gun was legally registered. So you can go through all of the paperwork. You can be the black person who doesn't have a record, who has good credit, who goes through all the measures, gets the gun, and the police officer can still kill you and will fight to keep it out of the record that you legally obtained your gun.
And so what sets the United States apart from the rest of the world is the intensity of white supremacy, militarism, and capitalism, not the particularities of guns.
Yeah, you know, I think it's some combination of both. You know, in the United States, there are more guns than there are people. Like, more guns than there are people. More children die by gun violence in the United States, I think, than anywhere else in the country. So there is definitely a gun violence problem, but I also know that there's also a problem of hetero-capitalist white supremacy. And that's not just found in manifestos written by fringe groups. It's found in our Constitution that enables the everyday, regular nature of white supremacy.
That was movement lawyer and activist Derica Purnell. Another movement lawyer, Shahid Buttar, is running for Congress to unseat Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi in her home district of San Francisco. Buttar is a lifelong activist and former director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Until now, he had rejected electoral politics. But this year, Buttar sees an opening for the left. He thinks his campaign is doing well.
We're really blowing away all our projections and expectations. Maybe not exactly my wildest dreams, but I ran last year in 2018 against Pelosi as well, and I was her leading progressive challenger in that cycle. And in that cycle, we ran for 3 months. We raised a little over $60,000. We got 17,000 votes. It was just short, about half a percentage point off of the runoff. This year, we launched 5 months ago with a ground game stronger than we ever built last year. We've been getting a ton of press. We've raised already in the campaign about three times what I did last year, and we still have a full year before the general election. So I have a great deal of confidence. You know, I've said publicly that it feels like the speaker's campaigning on my behalf for all intents and purposes, just given how much she's been swerving off the track. And we've been very positively encouraged between the fundraising support, the endorsements, the press attention. Our campaign has been, and the ground game, our campaign's been substantially stronger than it was last year. And frankly, we're further along than I thought we would be by this point this year.
Lots of left Democrats have pinned their hopes on Bernie Sanders overcoming the roadblocks that the Democratic Party put in his way in 2016. But in 2020, in this race, that party is doing much the same, and they seem to be succeeding in splitting whatever progressive vote there is out there among a whole zoo of candidates, including Elizabeth Warren.
I think that's right. You certainly see the Democratic Party circling its wagons to prevent the grassroots insurgency that Bernie represents. And, you know, Bernie represents a full-throated rejection of the Democratic Party's long-established co-optation by capital. And I think that's why we see so many different candidates peddled out. I think at the end of the day, the Democratic Party's institutional strategy to deny Bernie the nomination ultimately will fail, if only because, you know, all of the centrist candidates, particularly Harris, Buttigieg, Beto, they've all faded and effectively collapsed. And so at this point, it basically is a three-way race between Bernie, who seems to be the front runner by any objective measure, the most important of which I think is the amount of support he's been able to attract. And with a million donors, there's nobody else in the field who's even close to him. You know, he's still effectively subjected to a corporate media blackout. And yet still, you know, he's polling very near the top in all of the early states, including here in California, where he's in the number one position last I saw. He, Liz Warren, and Joe Biden seem to be the top three candidates at the moment. I do think that as much as the Democratic Party establishment might try to derail a progressive ascent and reclamation of the party, I think their attempts will fail, if only because at the moment, after having cycled through Harris and Booker and Beto and Buttigieg, you know, the centrists' last gasp to deflect Bernie's ascent is Warren. And the reason that she has been rising in the polls is because establishment Democrats have been leaping to her campaign, recognizing it as their last hope to block the economic democracy that Bernie promotes and promises. And I think at the end of the day, a Warren versus Bernie debate is going to radicalize the entire electorate. Most Americans have never heard, frankly, any of Bernie's ideas, and they haven't heard most of the watered down versions of them that Liz presents. But if they have a chance to hear a debate that is bounded by, on the one hand, an unapologetic commitment to socialism, and on the other hand, a watered down version of capitalism that at least pays heed to social justice principles. And I think that's, you know, a fair description of Liz Warren's approach. I think that's a debate that would do incredible things to inform and inspire the American people. And I look forward not only to the results of the presidential election, but the way in which we, the people, are impacted by it. And I do see that the chance to narrow the field to Bernie and Warren presents a once in a lifetime opportunity for a movement to expand our ranks and, frankly, you know, break millions of people out of the prison of ignorance that they've been stuck in due to the failures of our own corporate media system.
Now, you, of course, have your hands full in your race against Nancy Pelosi, but you do have some advice to Sanders supporters about how they ought to handle this challenge from Elizabeth Warren, who used to be seen as, well, one of his mentees.
I do. In fact, and a couple things to note here. First, you know, I'm running for Congress largely because Bernie ran in 2016 for the presidency, and I want both to deliver Kamala Harris's hometown for his Not Me, Us campaign, and because I saw in his 2016 campaign two principles that for me were very influential as a longtime political actor who had, frankly, derided electoral politics as something of a distraction. He demonstrated in 2016 that the commitment to radical transformation is one that not only he shares and not only I have long shared, but one that millions of Americans have shared. You know, he basically uncorked the bottle and revealed that the commitment to human needs is a majority position within the United States. And that, frankly, was a revelation to me. I did not realize how much support we had until Bernie's campaign established it. And then the second thing that he did in 2016, and this is where I, you know, really invite Bernie supporters to think about, is building a movement. He in 2016, and I think he continues to do today in his 2020 campaign, Bernie has demonstrated how electoral campaigns, rather than extract energy from social justice movements, can add energy to it. Now, he represents the movement in his policies. He shouts out movement organizations on the trail. His supporters are getting connected to and deployed to support frontline organizations like labor unions, for instance, that are on strike. That's the recipe, that's the playbook, let's say, on which we built our campaign, modeling his movement supporting efforts then and now. And what I would say to Bernie supporters is take a page out of that book. We're not just here as atomized individual actors. We're not just here to elect a candidate for president. We are here, all of us, not me, but us. We are here to build and amplify a movement. And the movement's opportunity at the moment, as Liz ascends in the polls and slides at points to the left, the opportunity for the movement here is to claim her ascent as a victory, not for Bernie, but for the movement. Because if we do that, it can reinforce Bernie's leadership, his rhetorical, discursive, visionary leadership that Liz's ascent reinforces. And I think a lot of Bernie supporters perceive Liz's rise in the polls as a threat. And my central advice to Berners is claim that as a victory, not as a threat, because if we do that, it both invites her supporters into the Bernie field, and we have to recognize that if we want Bernie to win the White House, we're going to have to persuade some of her supporters, and we don't do that by attacking them, certainly on, you know, ad hominem attacks. I think the policy critiques and contrasts are important to draw. Our last advice there was to focus on Biden first, narrow the field, so that as we're making contrasts, Warren doesn't have the cover of a conservative Democrat and Biden to make her look more reasonable by comparison. So, you know, if I were to summarize that, it's A, treat everybody with respect, especially the supporters of other candidates, because we need to keep their ears open and their ears are only open if our arms are open, to focus fire on the right wing of the party to neutralize it so we can have, if not an intra-left debate, at least a left-center debate instead of a left-right debate within the Democratic Party. And finally, to embrace Liz, if not as an ally, at least as a strategic voice whose shifts reinforce the visionary leadership of the candidate we as Bernie supporters want to see in the White House.
Now, you've been talking to Black Agenda Report for years, since your days as head of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And we know you as an anti-imperialist. But Bernie Sanders' record is not that. And even in his most recent debate, he spoke of the president of Venezuela, Maduro, as a tyrant.
And it is disappointing. You know, foreign policy is one of the areas where even the voices we have that nominally represent the left don't necessarily represent all of our aspirations. And over the last week, there have been a number of climate strike actions around the country. We were part of climate strike actions in San Francisco. Twice over the last week, I spoke at the climate strike in San Jose, very committed to climate justice. And a lot of progressives forget, in fact, the theme of my remarks to the climate strike at San Jose was that many progressives and certainly a lot of climate justice activists forget Dr. King's analysis and the radical aspect of his analysis connecting militarism to capitalism and racism. All three of those intersecting evils bear themselves out in the climate chaos debate, and foreign policy is particularly where it becomes most apparent and where many of our voices on the left unfortunately fail to follow through with their own commitments. And I'd put it this way. The relationship between capitalism and climate chaos is fairly obvious, right? Fossil fuel companies want to make a buck. They do it by plundering natural resources, particularly oil, gas, and coal. And as we burn those resources, it heats the climate. So that's fairly obvious. And I think that is established. And there is a growing awareness within the climate justice movement of how capitalism threatens the future of the human species. Beyond that, though, you know, the racism and the militarism are two parts that you can't take your eye off. The racism is also quite obvious, particularly when we think about the role of frontline domestic communities being at the oftentimes point of extraction and oftentimes being subjected to the environmental racism of, you know, for instance, Hunters Point is a neighborhood here in San Francisco, one of the last remaining African-American enclaves, and the cancer rates in Hunters Point are through the roof. And it's because the Navy poisoned the soil in that community for years while running a shipyard. It's not exactly climate, but it represents this point about particularly low income and particularly communities of color being forced to endure the worst aspects of the negative health externalities that these industries force onto to everyone surrounding them. And then the militarism gets often overlooked. But I would just point to indigenous communities in the Amazon. We know at the moment that with the CIA's support, Bolsonaro is ravaging the Amazon. And so many people are blaming Brazil, but you know, we forget that our military-industrial complex here in the United States is what put him in office. And not only is the Pentagon the world's largest source of carbon pollution, the single institution that puts out the most carbon pollution in the world is the U.S. military. But in addition to that, what we use it for is to force foreign markets open to the capitalist extraction of resources. And so the connection between our military-industrial complex, its consumption, and its use to then drive racist resource exploitation, it's all part of a very vicious cycle. And, you know, when I see Bernie in his foreign policy, I'm glad to recognize that it is at least nominally more humane than the neoliberal consensus on colonial resource extraction. I am disappointed that it doesn't reflect the same commitment to peace and justice, the same commitment to human needs that his domestic platform does. But at the same time, as a movement actor who recognizes, you know, the way these things play out over the unfortunately limited time we have left to make serious changes to avoid the worst parts of climate catastrophe, I'm very eager to work with Bernie, get him in office, and continue pushing him towards a more sustainable position, not just in his domestic policy, but also in his foreign policy.
Your opponent, Nancy Pelosi, the top corporate Democrat, was dragged, it seemed, kicking and resisting to finally support impeachment.
That's absolutely right. I've been, for the better part of 2 years, frankly, aghast not only at our criminal president's mounting litany of crimes against our republic, but also the disturbing, very obvious, and frankly disqualifying complicity of the leader of the supposed opposition party. And it's not just failing to pull the trigger on impeachment. Speaker Pelosi has actively enabled the Trump administration at any of several points, you know, at the very beginning of the current Congress, by adopting the PAYGO rules. These are Republican fiscal austerity rules that deny the House effectively an equal process for domestic spending on social programs. And so it basically discriminatorily favors military-industrial complex spending instead of federal spending on affordable housing, for instance, or food stamps, or the needs of the American people. That was the very first thing she did. And to, you know, just think about other examples, she supported Trump's foreign policy on Venezuela, into Palestine. She gave him $4.5 billion to fund concentration camps while doing nothing at all to hold the administration responsible for its documented severe and continuing violations of international human rights, as well as the domestic rights of Americans. I mean, this is a random rabbit, but just to note this, when I visited the border outside San Diego about 2 months ago, I met with human rights activists at an organization called Al Otro Lado, and they shared with me a report written by Amnesty International documenting the particular experiences of many of their advocates. So these are U.S. citizens who are being denied the right to leave the country because they're on a U.S. government watch list of human rights advocates. And I find that so incredibly disturbing. And that's among the reasons why impeachment is so necessary. It's not just the case that our government lacks the authority to deny citizens the right to leave the country. That is true. They have no right to deny anyone who is a citizen the right to leave the country. But in addition to that, our government doesn't have the right. We have a constitutional right not to be discriminated against based on what we believe. That's a First Amendment right. And the particular viewpoint that our government is currently discriminating against to assert an unconstitutional power happens to be commitments to the international human rights principles that we fought a world war to establish. And we're at one point very proud to support in the world. Each of those moments were disqualifying for me with respect to the speaker's unwillingness to hold a criminal president responsible. I am very glad that impeachment is now finally moving. We're very proud to have helped build the movement to force Speaker Pelosi to show up for work and fulfill her oath of office despite her documented unwillingness. I would say that the grounds for impeachment that the House is considering do appear radically under-inclusive. On the one hand, I am grateful for the whistleblower who has come forward with their findings. I'm also very grateful that even Republican senators and members of the House are alarmed, and I'm glad that they are also now willing to show up for work. In addition, however, I would note that the president's crimes against the republic include every dime of taxpayer dollars that he has put in his corrupt pocket. And the current impeachment proceedings appear to have no interest in exploring that. That is an investigation and a set of public findings to which I think the American people are very entitled. And I think an impeachment process that doesn't hold the president accountable for his lies, his obstruction, his incitements to violence, his self-enrichment at taxpayer expense is kind of like busting Al Capone for tax evasion. It's not to say that the whistleblower's findings are in any way not a big deal. They are a big deal. They should end his presidency. Other issues should also be implicated, particularly because, and this is key, if we want to remove Pence too, we have to pin the tail not just on the president's crimes and his complicity, I should say, his violation of the public trust in inviting a foreign leader's interference in our elections. But we also should look at the ways in which the vice president has helped enrich the president. Pence has stayed in Trump hotels on official state business. That is a violation of the Constitution's emoluments clause, the prohibition on self-enrichment through office. It's key that we not only impeach Trump, but that we get Pence too. The emoluments clause is the key to getting them both. And the proceeding under which Speaker Pelosi has finally started down the road, unfortunately, is limited and doesn't include that further set of facts. And that is a problem. But all that is to say, I'm very glad to see the House moving at all. I'm glad to see Speaker Pelosi finally show up. And I'm glad for the thousands of Americans from around the country who've been fueling our campaign to force her hand. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to demonstrate our chance to influence federal policy by dialing up the heat on Pelosi's left.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.